The more I see of a soldier's life, the more I like it. I have the satisfaction of becoming healthy, strong, and fat, having gained 5 pounds since I arrived here. This to me speaks favorably of the rough fare and accommodations of a soldier.
So wrote a soldier from Madison's Camp Randall on December 15, 1861. What does an extensive survey of letters from other Wisconsin Civil War soldiers reveal about their experiences and attitudes? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What do the letters of Wisconsin soldiers tell us about camp life, about battle, and northern attitudes toward slavery and emancipation? Our guests are John Zim, editor of This Wicked Rebellion, Wisconsin Civil War Soldiers Write Home, and Michael Edmonds, deputy director of the Wisconsin Historical Society's Library Archives.
Welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you.
This seems like such a treasure trove, this collection of letters, but I understand that it's just a small amount of what you have available as letters. Can you tell me something about what's there in terms of Wisconsin letters from Civil War soldiers and how you made the selection for this book?
The letters in this book came from one particular collection, the Quiner Collection, we called it. There are newspaper clippings that were assembled by Edmund Quiner and his daughters during the Civil War. They basically subscribed to all the Wisconsin newspapers they could and cut out letters from soldiers who were writing home, and in the end ended up with about 11,000 in 10 different volumes.
So these are letters that were published in newspapers, not just kept in a family dresser drawer.
That's right. They were. It was typical for a letter to be circulated with all the people who had known the family or the soldier, and that meant maybe sending it into the newspaper editor in Richland Center or Wausau or wherever the paper was being published. Quiner and his daughters meticulously pasted these into scrapbooks all during the war because he wanted to write a history of Wisconsin in the war afterwards. We selected them to digitize for a huge Civil War collection because they're set in type. We know that young people today can't read handwriting. It may as well be Chinese. Mm-hmm. And so we wanted to put online lots of letters that they could read. And then having done that, we could go back and John selected the very best ones to go in the book.
Do we know the names and the dates that go with these letters in most cases?
In many cases, we do. A lot of times, the soldiers would write with a pen name.
That's helpful.
One of my favorite is Peleg, which is from an obscure biblical reference, saying in his time the earth was divided. That was pretty clever. But sometimes we know some names, like Hiram Calkins shows up. But the dates, they're usually we know roughly at least when the letter is written.
From the events they're describing.
Yeah, and the letters from the newspaper would be dated too with the headline.
It made me kind of, I guess, regret the presence of email and Facebook and Twitter and everything else in the sense that these letters have such eloquence and such permanence. You know, I was struck by the way that ordinary men and a few women that you include wrote such beautiful letters and took such time with the language to get their ideas across. And they're telling about daily details, you know, what life was like in the camp, but sometimes they're also kind of waxing philosophical as well. What struck you most as you sort of read through the collection? What kind of general, you know, ideas did you come away with about the people who served in Wisconsin's Civil War brigades?
Yeah, I think what you say is absolutely right, that they were very highly literate, a way that we don't think of in previous wars. In fact, more letters were sent home from the Civil War front than from any other war up to that time. I think this is covered in the introduction, but I think in the Washington, D.C. post office in the fall of 1861, 40,000 letters a day were passing through from the front to families in the north. So these soldiers were very literate, and you can see for the first time in American working class regular guys what the experience of war was like.
And I gather the mail service worked pretty well during the Civil War. You could get a letter from one part of the country to another fairly quickly.
If all went well, it was about 2 weeks from the front to your family back in Wisconsin. Of course, it didn't always go well, but that's the average that historians calculate.
What are some of the unique features about it being Wisconsin soldiers? In other words, you know, this isn't Missouri, this isn't New England, it's Wisconsin. What kind of unique features do we find that make it so that you know it's Wisconsin?
Well, place names, you know, they'll write about, you know, the, you know, wondering how things are in Stoughton. And, you know, sometimes there's a letter in there, one of my favorites, where a snowstorm reminds some soldiers of winter in Madison and wondering how things are going there. And, you know, one thing I really like about these being all Wisconsin letters is I think it can bring us closer to the participants. Because, you know, we can, you know, they're from basically where we are. And, you know, some of the things, well, some of the names are familiar.
You have a section in your first chapter, War in the North, called Mutiny at Camp Randall. And I was wondering if you could talk a bit about Camp Randall, since it's just a few blocks from where we are now. Tell us what that was used for and what some of the letters reveal about Camp Randall.
Well, I think it was a pretty unique thing for the soldiers to see a military camp being put up where the state agricultural fairgrounds used to be just a couple of years earlier. And I wanted to include, and did include a fairly lengthy one describing in detail how it was being modified for, you know, to hold soldiers and later Confederate prisoners rather than, you know, horses and exhibits.
Can you share a sample?
There was originally a row of pens put up on the north, east, and south sides of the ground for the accommodation of the cattle brought here for the exhibition at the fair. These have been remodeled, good roofs put on, well sheeted and battened on each side, the interstices between the sheeting and the outside boards being filled with straw to break the force of the blasts of old Boreas and render them warm and tenable in cold weather. These pens, now termed barracks, are placed in bunks, three high, about 4.5 feet wide, and 6.5 feet long, in which we lodge. With a goodly quantity of straw in these, three men can make themselves a comfortable lodging place by spreading one man's blanket upon the straw upon which to lie, and placing those of the other two over the lodgers. I also like how he says here that they're coming down from the eminence upon which the hospital is situated and walking about 30 rods toward the north. We come to a large building sporting the sign of operative machinery. This is the shrine at which hungry soldiers worship. It is a building of about 240 feet in length and about 150 in breadth. Entering it, we find it filled with tables 130 feet in length, each of which is calculated to accommodate a company of soldiers. In this building, 3,000 soldiers sit down to their meals at once. I visited nearly all of the departments of the establishment, and I have luckily found a former acquaintance in every department I have visited.
You also have a letter about a mutiny at Camp Randall. Camp Randall was, among other things, was used as a holding place for Confederate prisoners, and things could get pretty contentious there. And we do have an account of a mutiny that really brings things to a head.
Right. There are a couple of cases that we could point out here. There's the 17th Wisconsin. Half of the 17th Wisconsin refused to go to the front until they had received their pay in the spring of 1862, which, you know, started a riot, and other troops had to come in and, you know, suppress these. But and the Confederate prisoners as well. It's kind of a unique time in Camp Randall's history. It was only a couple of months in the spring of 1862 as well where Confederate prisoners captured at Island Number 10 were brought.
In the Mississippi River.
Right.
Some of the soldiers were so young. Are there glimpses of that youth that you encounter as you're reading the letters where it's sort of a reminder many of them were teenagers?
I would like to think that the naivety of thinking that war was going to be fun was a sign of youth. Also, especially when you start getting into the chapters about camp life, finding the long descriptions of what their days were filled with and, you know, it being such a foreign environment, it's a good reminder that a lot of these men hadn't been very far away from home before.
There are also scattered through the letters references to people missing their mothers or wanting messages carried to their mothers, not their sweethearts or their kids, but their own mothers. And I can't remember the precise statistic, but the average age of Civil War soldiers was below 20.
Pretty young in any event, although it was also unusual by today's terms, wasn't it, in that some of the soldiers were much older than you would expect in an army today. I mean, ordinary soldiers, not officers. There is an account or two of an actual exchange of words between these Northern soldiers and Confederates. Well, we mentioned the confrontation with the prisoners of war, but also with the wounded. There's a letter or two that describes these rather poignant conversations.
Okay, this is after the Battle of Shiloh, where a man is walking over the battle and surveying the killed and wounded. And he writes, "While surveying the killed and wounded in a thickly wooded locality where trunks of large trees lay about in a half-rotten state, I stepped upon one to look about the ground, and hearing something move at my feet, looked down upon what was evidently the figure of a man, covered up by a blanket, and lying up alongside the log. The ground was thickly strewn about with bodies, many of whom I found to be only wounded. Lifting the blanket from the wounded man's face, as I dismounted from the log, he immediately faltered out, 'Oh, sir, I'm wounded. Don't hurt me. My leg is broken, and I'm so cold and wet.' Within 3 feet of this wounded secessionist lay a dead Unionist with his hair and whiskers burnt off. Just at this moment, two or three of our men came up, and observing the horrid spectacle of their dead companions in arms, with his hair, whiskers, and clothes burned, addressed the wounded man referred to in violent terms, accusing him of aiding and setting fire to their comrade. For a moment I felt apprehensive that they might retaliate, but upon his assuring them that many on both sides were burned in a similar manner, quiet was soon restored."
That's a good passage about how horrifying the battlefield experience was. No one anticipated this, but Americans hadn't been in a major war for a generation. And meanwhile, the Industrial Revolution had provided radically different kinds of weapons. And so instead of lining thousands of people up with muskets that might or might not hit their target, they were lining up with rifle-barreled guns, and they could hit anything at huge distances. And that battle, Shiloh or Pittsburgh Landing, was one of the first times observers realized that it was going to be a horrific experience, that they were going to kill themselves or kill each other by thousands at a time.
There's the combination of huge numbers of soldiers and rapidly expanding technological, you know, advances, if you want to call it that, really ramped things up in a hurry, didn't it?
That, and also that the officers who were older generally had all been trained in tactics and strategies that were based on inaccurate weapons and close range. And so they didn't have ways to move their armies around that corresponded with the more powerful technology that
they
had.
There's a terrible story about a Union general, and I can't quite remember which one now, who was assuring his men on horseback that, don't worry, they couldn't hit the broadside of a barn. And he didn't finish the sentence.
Is that Sedgwick, I think?
Sedgwick, yeah, that's what I was thinking, yes.
Well, and then you have the added horrible nature of a war in which you're killing within the same country, so you don't even have the sense of a foreign invading army.
Yeah, I think the Southerners, the Confederate soldiers, thought they had a foreign invading army coming at them. I mean, they were defending their homes, which is why, of course, if you travel in the South, they are still fighting that war in a way that we're not up here.
The passage you read reminded me a little bit of the short piece by Mark Twain called The Private History of a Campaign That Failed, where he talks about joining the Confederacy as a teenager, almost on a Boy Scout adventure. You know, it was a lark. And then coming face to face with his first dead body and sort of the grim reality of war that supersedes this initial naive lark or adventure. And I think that runs through this collection, The Wicked Rebellion, is that sense of, I guess, lost innocence.
Yeah. It was that led Whitman to say the real war will never get into the books.
Right.
And one of the reasons we built the digital collection was because we thought, well, the technology has changed since Whitman's day. You can put this in front of lots and lots of people, what the real truth, what the real war was.
Well,
like.
And Whitman, of course, had firsthand experience in that he was involved in the hospital aspect of the war. And I always suspected that he was not talking so much about the technology as the suppression of a lot of the grimmer side of that war. Well, speaking of the grim side, Wisconsin had a famous brigade that was involved in the very thickest part of the war, the Iron Brigade. And we have letters from them, I presume?
Yeah, one of the longer selections in the book is description of the battles that really gave the Iron Brigade its reputation. Here they call it Gainesville, but I think we call it Bronner's Farm now, up to South Mountain and Antietam. And, they really went from being, fairly inexperienced. I think one of the regiments had been at Bull Run, but the others hadn't seen a whole lot of combat yet. And they went from, being very inexperienced to having been in the thick of some really, really horrible engagements and doing quite well.
Bull Run became a kind of a taunt, wasn't it? We see in some of those letters that the Southerners or their Copperhead sympathizers would, when they confronted Union troops, I think we find it in Baltimore, when they're going through Baltimore maybe, they would be taunted with that Bull Run as being, of course, a notorious Union setback.
Yeah, I think it opened everyone's eyes to what the war would be like, because spectators came out from Washington, D.C. just to watch. It was supposed to be a sort of genteel thing to watch the battle from afar.
They would carry these picture frames, wouldn't they? And then they would literally frame up these battle scenes as if they were going to paint them. Yeah. It's definitely a shock for those picnickers for that first battle.
Yeah. And I think in the North particularly, people realized on that day that the war would not be short. It was not going to be 6 weeks like they all thought it was.
And the Iron Brigade, can you say just a little more about why they earned that name? And is there a passage from a letter that helps to capture some sense of them?
Yeah, there's a fair bit of a hyperbole in here, I think, but, talking about Bronner's Farm.
I will not say now whose was the fault, but of the division consisting of four brigades, two were not engaged at all, and one other but lightly. But Gibbons, the 2nd, 6th, and 7th Wisconsin, and 19th Indiana, which rebels have named the Black Hat Brigade, they wear black felt army hats, went into the fight. This was their first hard battle. As the sun was going down upon this pleasant August day, their line was formed and they stood face to face with three times their number, nowhere 100 yards distant, and in some places not more than 20. And for nearly an hour and a half, until entire darkness came upon the earth, the little hill whereon they stood was a roaring hell of fire. Retiring never an inch, with no confusion, now standing up, now flat upon the earth, now swaying backwards or forwards to get advantage of ground, the devoted 1800 blazed with fire. Line after line of the rebels confronted them and was swept away or broke in confusion. Fresh regiments would again appear upon the grounds their discomfited ranks had left, and with a cheer would rush on for a charge upon the black hats. But their rebel cheer was drowned and won three times louder by the Badger Boys, and their lines met the fate of their predecessors.
We'll look further at the Civil War through the eyes of Wisconsin soldiers when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. There never was an army like this for correspondence. Go through the camp at any time, any hour of the day, and you will see hundreds of soldiers when off duty writing letters. It is a picturesque sight. Some lie at full length on the ground beneath the shade of the trees with a board or a book for a table, with pen and ink, though often only a pencil, writing the news to their friends. Some stand upright against the trunks of the trees, some lean forward with their papers upon their knees, and some, with much painstaking, stand up and write. The remarks of a Boston reporter visiting troops during the American Civil War, early on in the war in 1861. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guests, Michael Edmonds and John Zim, who are sharing with us some of the letters from the book that has just come out, This Wicked Rebellion, Wisconsin Civil War Soldiers Write Home. We have, I think it's safe to say, all of the major Civil War battles represented in the experiences of these Wisconsin troops. How many Wisconsin soldiers in the war before it was all over?
Slightly over 90,000 Wisconsin troops participated. And as you say, there were Wisconsin troops present at all the major battles that we learn about in history books.
And I think you say that 11,000 men were killed either in battle or by illness during this war from Wisconsin?
That's right.
That's an astonishingly high number from just this state.
And about two-thirds of them died of disease rather than in combat. It was malaria and dysentery and other less romantic things that took away most of those lives.
You have a section called The Danger of Medicine, which is kind of an ironic title, but you make it clear that medical care was not always a help.
Right. Yeah. It seems like the hospital was only a step away from the morgue for the soldiers. And one of my favorite lighthearted takes on that is a letter on from Baton Rouge, where a soldier he recounts a conversation between a doctor and a sergeant during the sick call.
The doctor says, "What book comes first?"
"Sergeant, Company A."
"Company A. What's first name?"
"Smith."
"Well, Smith, what's the matter with you?"
"Bad diarrhea. Bones ache, sick in stomach."
"Here," taking two papers of powder from a pile. "Take one of these now, and if you don't feel better, take the other sometime during the day. Who comes next?"
"Brown."
"Well, Brown, what's the trouble?"
"Have a severe headache and bilious. Feel very sick."
"Here," takes two papers out of the same pile that he got for Smith. "Take one of them now, and if you don't feel better, take another. Who comes next?"
"Jones."
"Well, Jones, what's the matter with you?"
"Sprained my ankle while on picket yesterday. It is very painful. I am unable to duty."
"Well, here," takes from the same powder that he gave Smith and Brown. "Take one of them now, and in 2 hours take another. Who comes next?"
It's the whole take two aspirins and call me in the morning approach, isn't it?
Regardless of what the issue is, right.
Yeah, I like the conclusion where he says the miserable farce goes on until all have been attended to. The same remedy is given for sore throat as for a sprained ankle. A volunteer in the U.S. Army considers himself as a doomed man when he is once in the clutches of the hospital.
And, of course, we don't even know what the powder was after all of that.
There are other great anecdotes of the surgeons staying behind the lines and running from the very battles into which all their mates had to go and fight.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the causes behind the war and the extent to which the soldiers were aware of that, starting with the whole issue of slavery. I found it very interesting in your fourth chapter, Slavery, Emancipation, and African Americans, how ambivalent some of the feelings were for Wisconsin soldiers about the slaves they were supposedly trying to free.
Yeah, they expressed a wide range of opinions in this collection.
And did we see really a predominance that they were fighting for the Union rather than the freeing of the slaves?
Yeah, I wanted to go there first, which is I think that when the war broke out and most Wisconsin troops enlisted, they had never met a black person. Slavery was not an important issue to most of those 90,000 people when they started out. But as they got south and saw slavery up close, because many former slaves were coming behind Union lines and ending up working in the camps, so forth, their opinions gradually changed. And you can really see this in the letters over the course of the war. People who didn't care about the issue of slavery but went in order to preserve the Union or preserve the experiment in democracy that was America, they realized that those 18th century principles have to apply to everybody. And slavery becomes one of the prime motivators.
There's one letter in particular I remember where the soldier writing home seemed so struck by the fact that the slave was a man and that the slave was, in fact, longing for freedom, as if surprised by that fact.
Here's a description by one Wisconsin soldier of a confrontation with a slave. He had seen the curse of slavery in all its phases. He had seen his own children handcuffed and driven together with others in a gang to the south for market. He had seen the poor fellows whipped, and whipped so that their backs were covered with blood, and had seen the salt sprinkled upon them. I cannot tell you all that he told me now. Wait till I come home. We asked him if he didn't wish to be free. "Oh," said he, "I've been waiting for the time this 50 years, but it has not yet come. I would go with you now, but I cannot leave my poor old wife and children who live with me in yon cabin. No, you fellows tell us, and Massa, he tell the neighbor, that the thing look a little rough." He said it had never looked right to him that he should be kept down, a slave. In fact, he talked just like a man. He was 50 years old, but had never had the chance to learn to read. He stayed with us 2 hours, and when he parted our company, we told him that 1,000,000 soldiers were now at work to set him free. The old slave gave us his hand and blessing, and turning away with a tear in his eyes, he said, "I will wait. I love the Union soldiers. I hope we shall be free." And a conversation that obviously had an impact on the soldier.
And there are several letters in the book like discussing similar situations.
So we have a lot of confrontations like this that are described by these Wisconsin soldiers in their letters.
Yeah, there's another one a few pages later where a slave explaining why he wasn't going to escape, saying, "Gentlemen, I will not. I love my wife as well as any white man loves his. I intend to do my duty by her as well as a man in my circumstances can. And unless fate separates us, I shall remain with my master, and I can take off my hat and politely bid him farewell."
What evidence do you see of racism in these letters, the sort of other side?
It's obviously widespread because the Wisconsin soldiers were ignorant in whatever if mental concepts they had of black people had been formed by them, what was then the mass media. And, of course, it was racist. And they brought that south with them. The N-word we don't want to say on the air is all through these letters, as are many, many stereotypes.
You hear of a soldier who casually says, "I care not perhaps as much as some about the freedom of the slave." Another saying, "We are of the same opinion in regard to the cause of this war, that is, that the abolitionists of the North alone are to blame."
So you had a diverse group of viewpoints, really. I mean, you had thousands of soldiers, you're going to have thousands of different backgrounds and thousands of different viewpoints when it comes to slavery.
If there's a common theme, one of the things you see in the letters is the shift among soldiers to thinking that it's an important issue. It's a peripheral issue for most of them at the start of the war. But then with more experience, they begin to see that the war is, in fact, about slavery and the extension of democracy to these 4 million people who have never experienced it.
Well, and that reflects Lincoln's shift of thinking, too, going from saying in his first inaugural address something to the effect of, "Well, we're not interested in freeing the slaves," and him saying, "If I could preserve the Union by freeing some of them or none of them, I would do whichever it would take." And then, of course, the Emancipation Proclamation, January 1st of 63.
And the second inaugural address where he makes it clear it's a sin. What can you say about the letters and a sense of spirituality? I mean, a lot of the soldiers writing home are deeply religious. They're struggling with notions of good and evil and sin and so on. What kinds of things struck you in that regard as you worked through the collection?
Well, it didn't play as a big a part in what soldiers wrote about as I would think. I can think of a particular account where one soldier fears for the people who instigated slavery or who were perpetuating it because of what they would face on Judgment Day, and you know, for the state of human degradation. But altogether, it wasn't, there wasn't a lot of overt religiosity in most of the letters. There was one letter from a clergyman, but he's writing about Colonel Payne refusing to return slaves.
Yeah, that's a good story.
Yeah, Reverend Barry, chaplain of the 4th Regiment, he returned to the state and had a few remarks in Kenosha, and he apparently spent most of his time talking about Colonel Payne of the 4th Wisconsin, who refused to give up slaves who had come into the lines. And, his exact words were, "Colonel Payne refused to give up the slaves to those human bloodhounds." And Payne, of course, is after that deprived of his command, put under arrest, and all for refusing to return slaves to their owners, their masters.
There's a lot of documentation on the website about this and similar incidents. And it's wonderful for teachers because it raises the issue of when do you obey authority and when mm-hmm. do you not obey authority? And particularly in a military situation, how could they refuse to obey their commanding officers? And Payne was a Milwaukee attorney who was in charge of one of the regiments and simply refused to do it. He was court-martialed and arrested. But the general over him, a few weeks or months later, was relieved of command, and he was reinstituted. And there's in the letters a great description of all his men cheering him when he returns. But it's a thing that a teacher could use for...
Even a teacher in the military, because, of course, throughout the years, especially as we get into, say, the Vietnam War, we see instances where these orders were not obeyed, and they come into the news pretty prominently in some of these cases.
Well, and it's such a tricky situation with the fugitive slave law and some of the other situations where someone could be free in one state but not in another, and regarded as not fully human in the eyes of the law, and just the whole tricky business of measuring a person differently from state to state. It raises some absurd situations that I think come out in the letters as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's one account of soldiers running across a couple of young slaves, asking them, they're in Missouri, just across the river from Illinois, and asks these young men, you know, why don't you escape? And he found that they had been told all their lives that there were men in Illinois who were looking to make money, you know, $50 a piece for returning slaves back to Missouri. Whether or not that's true, I have no clue. Even the soldier who writes it said, I do not believe half they told me about it. The fact is they are made to believe it when they are young, and they grow up with that idea till it becomes a fixed fact to them.
Well, we do tend to overlook all the misinformation that was floating around during the war. For example, some of the letters refer to rumors that Washington had been taken by the Confederates and that Lincoln had been taken prisoner. And how long does it take to dispel a rumor like that that would affect, you know, the morale of the troops?
Yeah, that's a whole issue that you alluded to at the start when you inquired about how long the letters took to get from place to place. But this was a war where the telegraph was run along railroad lines for the first time, and so they could have rapid communication
when it wasn't
about
cut.
What was going on. When it wasn't cut, that's right. That's right.
What are some of the striking things about daily life for soldiers? I mean, you have chapters that are called bridge building and trench digging, dealing with the elements, all kinds of things, but you know, if you just look at it in terms of the work that was done, the life that was lived, are there things that jump out to you as striking examples of the kinds of details were given in these letters for what it was really like?
How about the mud letter?
Okay.
Mud. You know, the Civil War, and I think it was probably an unusually rainy 4 years by all the accounts of mud in the Civil War and having to push things uphill through mud.
Right. And I think it's kind of interesting. You know, we can kind of compartmentalize saying, you know, there are soldiers, they did this, they went there. But, you know, when you think of an actual human being had to wear a wool uniform in the summertime, sleep in a tent for months and years on end, it's pretty remarkable.
It's remarkable that more of them didn't die.
Right. And the mud letter is one of my favorite polemics in the book, where a soldier identified only as Stu tells us, "There's nothing here to write about but mud. Anything else but mud is a rarity. Everything is covered with mud. Men and horses, soldiers and teamsters, tents and wagons, food and raiment are covered with mud. Horses sink to their knees and wagons to the hubs, from Chainbridge to Langley's, and from there to this place is, if possible, worse. The days are dark and gloomy, and the fogs are so dense and murky that some of your Berlin citizens, with whom I am acquainted, could not see the end of their long noses were it not for the fiery glow that rests on the top." Yeah, and he continues to say mud, gloom, rain, dirt, cold coffee, leaky tents, salt junk, hard crackers, want of exercise, ennui, blues, blue devils. Damn, yes, damn everything. The army, the rations, the rebels, and the mucilaginous mud. The generals who don't fight and the cabinet who won't make them fight. The Congress who keep talking about proclamations of emancipation when the only proclamation needed and the one that will do all the work they keep jabbering about is an order to march. Yes, I say again, damn everything but the Union. But God bless the Union, mud and all.
That's a great letter. It is. It's such a concrete, you know, list of things, and it's just very hard-hitting.
When you do get a sense from that, too, of how, well, he mentions the word ennui, I think, how boring life can be when you're not terrified and in combat. I mean, take your choice. You can be bored or terrified.
You also have sections on holidays away from home and others that get a sense of the homesickness of what they were missing by being in the mud and away from home. What are some of the sort of poignant moments in terms of their realization of what they had left behind and what they were no longer sharing in?
The little things like snowfall or, you know, dates. There's a letter on December 23rd, right before Christmas, you know, talking about home. And it reminds you that, you know, they are young, you know, boys, basically, who had to fight this war. And not only did they have to live through the mud, but give up time with their family and their life at home to fight this war.
We have letters from prisoners of war, too, don't we, in this collection?
There are 200 letters in the book, and there are 11,000 on the website. And you can search the website for subjects like grief, I don't think boredom, but combat, or the items, the characteristics, the features of daily life can all be searched on the website. So you can find letters that
I noticed in the book you do have pictures of Libby Prison in Richmond and Andersonville, of course, the most notorious of all the camps where so many thousands of Union soldiers died in Andersonville in particular.
Yeah, and that's there's a letter in the book written from Chattanooga in 1864 talking about one of the Wisconsin soldiers who was captured at Chickamauga who escaped from Andersonville and, you know, talking about the really horrid and awful conditions there and the awful treatment, you know, sleeping on the ground without blankets, you know, 19,000 men, you know, crammed into an area of 12 acres of ground.
It's remarkable in a way that those letters actually got home from those places in those circumstances.
And there was no kind of censorship of letters? I mean, these letters would be written and they would – did anybody screen them the way so often things are blacked out in later letters?
They were not screened at the front by superior officers. And I don't believe there were restrictions on what they were told they could say. But what you see in the book is presumably a somewhat cleaned up version because the letters ended up in an editor's hand at a newspaper.
Right. So they could well have been screened there.
That's right. Or made more vivid, I think, in some of the more colorful ones we've heard today. I think I hear the voice of an editor, not a soldier.
Well, and presumably they would have maybe not included in a newspaper something that was very specific to a family, you know, how is Aunt Sally's rheumatism kind of things might have gotten deleted.
Right. And they might have also unilaterally suppressed anything that they thought would jeopardize the safety of the troops.
So just to backtrack a little bit, these letters got to the newspapers how? The soldiers actually sent them to the newspapers?
Yeah, oftentimes soldiers would talk to the editor before they left and you know, come to some sort of agreement to send letters from the, you know, from the front. And, you know, there are also several letters that a family apparently brought to a paper to have printed. You know, it'll be addressed, you know, dear father, or, you know, dear mother.
Some of the soldiers had actually worked for newspapers before the war. And there's a wonderful account of a company from Wisconsin in Tennessee, when a town is occupied, taking over the newspaper office and printing the regimental paper for during the summer that they were there. which is an extraordinarily rare item. They knew who they were writing to when they were writing back. Also, each regiment was supposed to have a civilian agent who was their advocate along with them, and some of those people were writing back to the newspaper. I think you have several letters from agents. Mm-hmm. Civilian
kind
agents.
Kind of PR agents? Or?
No, they were supposed to intervene on issues like health, medicine, supplies, and be the liaison between the unit and the home front that was supplying bandages, clothing, food, etc.
And we'll look more at the letters of the Civil War soldiers from Wisconsin when we continue in a moment with University of the Air. Never can be reconciled to this cruel separation. How long, oh, how long shall the tocsin of war resound through our valleys and through our mountains? How long must we hear the drum reveille and the bugle's shrill call to arms? My country, oh, my country, what a sacrifice thy daughters offer at thy shrine. Fathers, brothers, husbands, sons, and lovers, these no more, but soldiers, we lay upon thy holy altar. How patriotic the heart, how weak the flesh. That's from a letter from the wife of a soldier in the 10th Wisconsin, sharing the pain of being separated from her husband, one of many letters included in This Wicked Rebellion, Wisconsin Civil War Soldiers Write Home. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland, and our two guests, John Zim, the editor of the book, and Michael Edmonds of the State Historical Society, and we're talking about Wisconsin Civil War soldiers. That letter from the wife struck me, and it is a reminder, I think, to all of us of the cost of any war. Are there other moments like that where you're sort of aware of just the cost? I mean, all aside from the time and place, just the way any war causes such suffering.
Yeah, one of my favorite clippings, I tell my 7-year-old that he's the reason that this is in the book. Very early in the book, there's a clipping talking about a soldier leaving, and the husband was taking last leave of his wife. A hasty kiss was arranged, a warm grasp of the hand, and the soldier, as he was about turning away, stooped to kiss his child, a little girl of 3 summers. The child put her arms around the father's neck, clasped them tightly, and sobbed most piteously. She would not let him go, and he was forced to unclasp her hands with his own strong arms and hand her back to her weeping mother. That's, I think, even relevant today with, so we see on the news soldiers leaving or, the happier times when they're coming back and being greeted.
And it's a reminder of the families that are suffering, not just the soldiers in the mud, but the ones left at home.
Right.
The home front life was obviously turned upside down as well, and women were thrown into all sorts of roles that they hadn't embraced before. Obviously, women on the farm had to take over running the farm. There was a labor shortage for men and young men to work on the farm, and a lot of it fell to the mothers and wives left behind. Similarly, just as in World War II with Rosie the Riveter, women entered factories along lakeshore cities in large numbers, and just as in World War II, were displaced when the war ended and the soldiers all came home. But on the home front, I think it was a liberating event for many women to break out of the roles that they had been in prior to that.
I didn't notice any sort of Dear John letters in here in terms of someone breaking up with a soldier.
Probably wouldn't put it in the newspaper.
I don't remember ever seeing one, do you?
I don't either, no.
But you're right, they probably were there.
Probably there, but not published in newspapers for all to see. Yeah. But I assume that quite a few soldiers would return home to women who had changed quite a bit in their absence.
Yeah.
You have a soldier who was reflecting at the end of a battle in which a friend of his was killed. And that's something that we haven't touched on yet, is that human cost, the effect of those deaths on the survivors.
Yeah. This soldiers were, you know, really kind of a, they were a close-knit group, oftentimes even before joining the regiments.
Often tended to come from, yeah,
the same communities.
Same communities, right.
Right, so, you know, they could be watching people that they'd known, you know, since boyhood, you know, dying and wasting away in hospitals. Yeah, the letter of, you know, one guy writing about his friend Charlie, he said, "I have felt as though I had, ever since Charlie died, I have felt as though I had not a friend left. Charlie was my friend, and a braver or better boy never shouldered a gun or slung a knapsack." As our chaplain said at his grave, "It does seem as though our truest and best boys were taken from us first. Charlie's parents, God help them in their hour of their sorest trial. Tears come unbidden to my eyes while thinking of the sorrow his death will cause in the far-off home of theirs. They cannot help but think that this calamity might have been averted if they had only listened to the dictates of their own hearts and kept their darling boy at home."
We talk a lot today about PTSD among soldiers, but do you find, you know, if you were a clinician who studied that, would you find evidence of that in any of the letters that some of the soldiers are showing signs of trauma?
There are two. I have to point out that I'm not clinically trained in any way, shape, or form. But there are actually two letters that come to mind. There's a soldier wrote about camping on the old Bull Run battlefield a year after. And one of the officers that was with them had been badly wounded at the battle. And this soldier says something like, "It was, you know, a very uncomfortable place for this man to camp overnight." There's also a letter in the book, a letter home to a wife whose husband had committed suicide in Kentucky after having been wounded.
And these battlefield experiences, that is, you know, I'll call it a cold battlefield experience, are remarkable too, aren't they? And that there's this sort of casual mention about kicking up skulls and the grass being still thick with bullets months after a battle, and the shallow kind of haphazard graves.
With so many bodies to bury, I guess they had to do it quickly.
The modern practice of embalming, since we're talking about death, the modern practice of embalming was invented during the Civil War because so many bodies had to be shipped home, and no one knew how to do it in a hygienic way until the war, when a particular physician in Washington came up with essentially the practice that has been used ever since.
It was used on Lincoln, although not with tremendous success in his case either.
You write about some of the grimness of the death, the bodies and so on, but along the way, as they're exploring new areas that they'd never been before, they also see beautiful landscape and scenery. You've got sections called Soldier Scientist or, you know, various kinds of reflections. They do get to see a broader world. Do you find some sort of almost lyrical passages in which, despite the horror of war, they are seeing the beauty?
Yeah, the soldiers had a lot of time on their hands, generally. You know, they weren't going into battle every day. And, you know, there's time even when they were marching to and fro about the countryside to have a look around and comment on that. And, yeah, there's one of my, you know, nice comment in here is, "This would be a lovely country to live in if it weren't for slavery."
Talking about the South.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
And there are many passages about what they see as an early spring and everything turning green and blossoming at a time when back home, of course, there's still snow on the ground.
Yeah. Yeah, another soldier writes about after it does snow, how nice it is to see snow, because normally winter is the rainy season and we end up with more of that mud.
Yeah, there were on the other side stories about the soldiers who had, if it was too hot, they just would dump their coats. They would literally just throw them on the roadside, and then a day or two later the temperature drops 30 degrees, and that's where a lot of your non-combat fatalities came in. This whole theme of naivete that we've talked about, it seems so much more prominent during the Civil War, that these soldiers came from backgrounds that were not, well, they just didn't have the training that a lot of soldiers would have in later wars.
And the letters show them as intensely human. I mean, it looks naive in a sense because we see such a narrow range of real human emotion in mass media today. But what you see in the letters is real, genuine, authentic feeling across the whole spectrum of what humans are capable of. It's a wonderful, wonderful resource for seeing what it was actually like for real people as they dealt with challenges that they never face, that most of us never face.
Are there moments that stand out for you as heroic, where even though we're reading about ordinary people with a full range of emotion, with a spectrum from good to bad and all the rest of it, are there times when you were reading a letter and you sort of marveled at the heroism of a soldier?
I remember one where the soldier recounts the flag carrier who was no longer able to carry it, and the soldier, you know, grabbing it and having the honor of actually taking it to the top and planting it.
I think one heroic moment that we talked about earlier was Colonel Payne refusing to return escaped slaves. He actually risked a lot in an era where reputation and what he had gained as an officer cost a lot to give up.
And he followed a higher law than the law of his land.
Right.
Wisconsin lost a governor in that war, but not to combat.
Right. Governor Harvey drowned after traveling to visit Wisconsin troops after Shiloh.
And sort of in conclusion, what would you say about Wisconsin and the Civil War? How do we come out?
And yes. Do we have letters about the return of the troops?
Oh, we do. In fact, there's the last letter in the book. Actually, there's one in the beginning and one at the end. One letter in the beginning, interestingly, points out how after the 1st Wisconsin, which is a 90-day regiment, came back, mothers hesitated before kissing their own sons because they looked so different after just a few months. But then, you know, the last letter talks about the return of the 2nd Wisconsin and how few men actually were coming back, made them think about the day that they left Madison. And, you know, there was celebration and cheering, and then, you know, just a small remnant left to return.
And before we forget, that website address to find these letters?
Thank you. It's simply wisconsinhistory.org/civilwar, and you'll find all the letters that aren't in the book, as well as dozens of diaries and memoirs and other resource eyewitness accounts of Wisconsin in the war.
And searchable by many topics.
Right.
That's a wonderful treasure.
Thanks for joining us this hour and sharing some of the letters from those Wisconsin Civil War soldiers. Our guests have been John Zim and Michael Edmonds. And thanks to Adam Friedrich for voicing some of our Wisconsin Civil War soldiers. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.